Hey, why is the eigenvalue of L squared always bigger than the square of the eigenvalue of LZ? Excerpt of actual student answer. You cannot establish L as being completely in the Z direction. Doing so would require you to know LZ, LX, and LY simultaneously. It would violate the uncertainty principle. Simple way to think about it is classically having LZ in the Z direction would mean your particle is entirely in the next Y plane. So that means you know its Z position and you know PZ. Can't happen in quantum mechanics. Other questions. How can L be broken into three components, LX, LY, and LZ, if it doesn't have three components? The point is that the operator, which represents the angular momentum, has three components. It doesn't have simultaneous eigenvalues to those three components because they don't all commute. So you can't measure them at the same time. The reading seems at odds with the spins program we've been using. After passing through the first detector, we determine the particle's spin projection along the z-axis. Next, we determine its projection along the x-axis. We nail down the z-component. Doesn't it then become impossible to determine the projection along the x-axis? If you measure it along the x-axis, you have to get some answer. That'll be one of its eigenvalues of the LX operator. But now that you've measured LX, you've disturbed what LZ is, so it no longer has that Z component that you measured before. Just like when you measure position and then measure momentum, it no longer doesn't have to have the same position anymore once you've measured the momentum. That's the uncertainty principle again. Angular momentum. Does this refer to a whole new set of quantum numbers, or does this simply explain the quantum number L in more detail? So, those L's and M's that we found in solving our three-dimensional Schrodinger equation are the same L's and M's of angular momentum. What does the hydrogen wave function tell us physically? So it tells us the probability of finding the electron at any given r, theta, and phi, and it also tells us the result of any possible measurement, the expectation value of any possible measurement. Once you figure out what operator corresponds to your measuring apparatus, and you can take an expectation value using that hydrogen wave function for the particular state of hydrogen you've prepared, and it will tell you the expectation value for any possible measurement. So it tells you everything you could possibly know about hydrogen. I'm not entirely sure what Griffiths means when he says that LX, LY, and LZ are incompatible observables. They're incompatible because they don't commute. So just like position and momentum don't commute, can't measure both at the same time. You can't be in an eigenstate of both at the same time. I still don't really understand what an eigenstate, eigenvalue, or eigenfunction is. How do we picture these values or functions other than just numbers of something? I guess I'm asking what the context of these numbers are once we get them. What do they tell us? So the eigenvalues tell us the possible values for whatever operator we're looking at. If you do a measurement of that operator, like angular momentum, your experiment can only give you one of those eigenvalues. And if you're in an eigenstate, then you know which eigenvalue it has to be. And an eigenfunction is just, well, if your eigenstate depends on some continuous variables, then you can write an eigenfunction. But in general, an eigenstate is more general than an eigenfunction. Any other questions? So last time we solved the hydrogen atom, we found the eigenfunctions. We found there were three quantum numbers. There was a principal quantum number that starts at 1. That tells us the energy levels. The energy level went like 1 over n squared. There were two angular momentum quantum numbers, L, which starts at 0 and goes up to n minus 1, and M, which goes from 0 to plus or minus L. So for a fixed value of n and L, there are 2L plus 1 possible values of M, because plus or minus comes in pairs, and 0 is by itself. So if we want to know how many states there can be with the same energy level, so what's the degeneracy of the energy level with principal quantum number n? We would take sum from L equals 0 up to n minus 1. Those are the possible values of L. For each one of those L's, there's 2L plus 1 values of M. So we just take that sum. So we can separate it into 1. That's an easy one to do. And 2 times the sum of L from 0 to n minus 1. So the sum of 1 from 0 to n minus 1 is n, because there's n terms in that series. And the sum of L from 0 to n minus 1 is the upper limit times the upper limit plus 1 over 2. And we had a factor of 2 out front. That we were supposed to learn that in 9th grade. I don't know. You guys learned it at some point. So that's n squared minus n, and we have plus n from here, so the n's cancel, we get n squared. There's n squared possible states with that energy. So last time, we found this recursion relation that tells us the polynomial in the wave function. So some people get tired of working out those recursion relations, so they found a tricky way to get the answer. So that polynomial piece that we called V last time is an associated Laguerre polynomial. So that's another famous that French guy. And it's written like this. You find that Laguerre polynomial is minus 1 to the p, p's derivative of the Laguerre polynomial. Same Laguerre, which is the solution of some other equation. And there's a shortcut for finding those polynomials. So these formulas are just pulled out of some French hat. So you can either use these formulas, or you can look in the book and try and find where the one you want is, if the numbers aren't too big. Or you can use the recursion relations. They all tell you the same thing. And on the exam, you'll look on the formula sheet. But someday, when you're in graduate school, you might need the 200th wave function, and then this will be the easiest way to get it. So, what can we do with these wave functions? Well, we were supposed to normalize them. So if we take a product of two wave functions, complex conjugate one, and they have different values of n, l, and m. One is l and n, l, and m, and one is n prime, l prime, and m prime. And we integrate over R all space. So that's r squared dr sine theta d phi. And we're supposed to know that that's either 1 or 0. It's 1 if the quantum numbers are the same. So delta n, n prime, delta l, l prime, delta m, m prime. And 0 if any one of them are different. That's the same as when you did linear algebra. Eigenvectors are orthogonal. Eigenfunctions are also orthogonal. And we've normalized them, so they're orthonormal. Then, if we wanted to calculate the expectation value of some operator, we would put that operator in between the wave functions. And if we got tired of writing that, once we put an operator in, that gives us the expectation value. We probably want the expectation value of a particular state, so we could write it like this. NLM specifies the state, we put an operator in the middle, and then we take the overlap of the complex conjugate of that state. That's how we get expectation values in quantum mechanics. So that's just like first order. So let's calculate some things. So given that the m takes on its maximum value, L takes its maximum value, what's the most probable value of R and the expectation value of R? So that means L equals n minus 1. And our radial wave function in that case is some constant times R to the n minus 1 e to the minus R over nA. So we checked that last time. What happens for those, the solution of the radial part of the wave function when L is n minus 1. So the radial probability, that is the probability to find the electron as a function of R, goes like R squared, little r squared, capital R squared. Because we'd have to put it in that overlap integral. So the maximum, we want to maximize this probability. We want to find the most likely value of R. So we're going to find where this function has a local maximum. And we don't have to worry about the angular part of the wave function because that's normalized to 1. So this is a squared r squared r to the 2n minus 2 e to the minus 2 r over nA. So if we just differentiate that probability with respect to R, a squared comes out, differentiating this, we get 2n r to the 2n minus 1, and then this exponential is still there. Differentiating the exponential, we'll get an r to the 2n times minus 2 over nA. So just this coefficient in the exponential. And we want to find when that's 0. So that happens when these two cancel. So 2n r to the 2n minus 1, we'll call it r max. So all but one power of R max cancels. So multiplying by NA, you get R max is N squared A. And if it was an exam, we check that we got the units correct. So A is a Bohr radius, so this has units of length. So better be the first power is supposed to be a radius. So that's the most likely place to find the electron. What's the expectation value? So to calculate the expectation value, we need to know what that normalization factor A is. Supposed to have normalized the radial part of the wave function to 1. So if we put in our radial wave function squared as a factor of a squared, integrate from 0 to infinity, that answer is supposed to be 1. So we'll pick a to make that true. Convenient integral that you'll have on your formula sheet on the exam some power of x, x to the m, e to the minus bx, integrated from 0 to infinity, is m factorial over b to the n plus 1. So in our case, m is equal to 2n, and b is 2 over na. So a squared times 2n factorial over 2 over na to the 2n plus 1 power is equal to 1. So a is the square root of 2 to the 2n plus 1 over na to the 2n plus 1, 2n factorial. Simple? Value of R put another yep
in your denominator m factorial over b is that raised to that m plus 1 not n plus 1
no n in that formula. So to calculate the expectation value, put in the operator, which represents what we're measuring. So the operator that we're measuring is R. So you just have to put an R. Since it's just R, it doesn't have any derivatives, we don't have to worry about putting it in the right place. We can put it anywhere. If it was a derivative, then we'd have to make sure there's psi star on the left, derivative, then the wave function. Then we'll have R a squared R to the 2n e to the minus 2r over na dr. So we have the same integral now with one more power. So m is now 2n plus 1. It's not the m of angular momentum, it's the m of Gradstein and Rydzyk. You guys know about Gradstein and Rydzyk? It's a big table of integrals. It's thick. So once you finish being an undergrad, you don't have to. You look in Gradstein and Rydzyk instead of working out integrals yourself. Or you buy Mathematica, I guess. Although Mathematica doesn't usually work. You try to integrate something. Where were we? So this is a squared 2n plus 1 factorial. 2 over na 2n plus 2. And a squared is 2 to the 2n plus 1 over na to the 2n plus 1 2n factorial multiplied by 2n plus 1 factorial over 2 over na to the 2n plus 1. So 2n factorial cancels out this except for the factor of 2n plus 1. And then 2n plus 1 factors of na cancel against here, which leaves one factor of na, which will be up on top. And 2n plus 1 factors of 2 cancel 2n plus 1 factors of 2. There'll be one left over. So that's n squared plus n over 2 times a. So if we compare with what we had before, this is where the local maximum in the radial wave function was. The expectation value is not the same, but it's similar, especially for large n.
Why do they differ? Why do they differ?
So, I have some function that has some maximum value. The maximum is there, but if I integrate this multiplied by, weighted by r, why should it be the same? there's whenever you have a statistical distribution, there's a value that's the most likely, and there's the value that's the average. So the expectation value is like the average. So if we took everyone's height in the room, there's a height that most people have that height, but there's the average height. They're not the same thing. So if I asked you on an exam to calculate the expectation value of p squared, what would you do? So you might do this. So you could write out the components p squared or px squared plus py squared plus pz squared, write them as derivatives, put them in between the wave functions. You convert to angular coordinates, then you have to put in the ylms. Because in spherical coordinates, there would be angular dependence in those derivatives. And then 4 hours later, you get the answer. Or you could say that the Hamiltonian is p squared over 2m plus the potential. So p squared is h minus b times 2m. And we could take the expectation value of that. Expectation value of h is just the energy of the level. And then you have to work out the expectation value of the potential, which is doing one of these integrals with 1 over r instead of r to the 1. So you could choose whichever way seems easier to you. So you guys said you saw the spectral lines of hydrogen. So that's old hat. So I'm not going to go over it in class unless you guys had a particular question. So one more thing we can do with our hydrogen wave functions is we can we've also now solved a lot of ionized atoms. For example, if you look at helium, instead of one proton in the middle, it has two protons and two neutrons. So ionized helium has one electron going around that. That's our classical picture. So the size of this nucleus is tiny compared to the Bohr radius, many orders of magnitude smaller. So for as far as we're concerned, this is just a point with charge plus 2 instead of charge plus 1. We didn't have to take into account the structure of the proton in our calculation so far. So the only thing that changes in hydrogen, our potential was e squared over 4 pi epsilon naught, 1 over r. For helium, the nucleus has twice the charge, so there's a factor of 2. And I broke my rule of never writing epsilon naught again. So we could also do any atom that had z protons in the nucleus, as long as there's just one electron, so it's highly ionized. Put z in here where I have it too. So this is just the charge of the nucleus, this factor. So we've solved all atoms with a single electron going around. So all those ionized atoms. So why is this good? I mean, You don't have to resolve the whole thing again, right? You just have to scale the solution we already have. So the effect of this is that if we write it in terms of h bar c and alpha, we're replacing alpha by z times alpha. So you just go to the end of the calculation, and everywhere there's an alpha, put z times alpha. So the Bohr radius was h bar over alpha mc. So that would become h bar over z alpha mc. So the typical radius gets smaller. That makes sense, right? There's a stronger force pulling it in. The energy level was minus alpha squared mc squared over 2m squared. So that will become minus z squared alpha squared mc squared over 2n squared. So binding energy gets deeper. Again, makes sense because it's a deeper well because there's a bigger charge. Is there any questions? I'm going to show you some pretty pictures. So here's a sketch of the potential for hydrogen, and these dashed lines are the energy levels that we found, and you can recognize the 1 over n squared pattern, right? So this is n equals 1, so this is 13.6 electron volts below 0, where an electron infinity would be. So 1 over 2 squared puts you up here, 1 over 3 squared puts you up there. So as you go up, they're getting more and more closely spaced because they're going like 1 over n squared. So there's an infinite number of levels squeezed into this last little bit here. So if we look at that again, here's this black line is the potential, and here are the radial wave functions squared versus the so this is the radial direction r, and the wave functions are plotted on top of their energy levels, so you can keep them separated in your brain. So here is the ground state wave function. When you go to the first excited state, there are two possible values of L, because L can be 0 or 1 now. And there's a solution that only has a node at the origin and a node at infinity. And there's another solution with an extra node put in. So that's what you expect from solving standing waves, right? So which value of L is which?
Spherical symmetric, and the p orbital is then.
Yeah, but we don't have any spherical information here. This is just radial.
Well, the blue one next behind it looks a lot like the red one for the ground state.
Mm-hmm.
So you can assume that they have the same L value.
Well, we could guess that. So we checked earlier that the maximal value of L was just the power of R times the exponential. So this guy has to be the maximum one, because this guy is got more than one term in its polynomial in order to get to zero. And then these guys, they have, there's guys with two nodes hidden in that mess. I guess it's the, looks like the red one, doesn't it? Yeah, it's all squished. So let's expand it. So this must be the L equals 2 guy. It only has a node at 0 and a node at infinity. Then you can have an extra node or two extra nodes, and so on. So here is a simulation. Remember we did the particle in a box? So we prepare the same hydrogen atom in the same way. So it's an N equals 1, L equals 0, M equals 0. We do it 1,000 times and we measure the position. And what you see is there's not much structure, right? It's mostly around a Bohr radius away from the center, spherically symmetric. If you go up to the N equals 2, L equals 0, then you should see that there's slightly less around this this certain radius. That's our node. And then L equals 1. Now we have a non-trivial angular wave function. So we have two blobs coming out. Remember we drew those Legendre polynomials? So who can tell me where the z direction is? So all of our wave functions were, the probabilities are independent of phi, because we have an axial, there's a symmetry around the z-axis. Because the wave function was e to the I m phi, so when we square that, the phi dependence cancels out when we take the modulus. So the z-axis is going along this way, and then we're spinning it because it's nicer to spin things this way. But if you spun it around a symmetric axis, you wouldn't see anything interesting. So
I have a question.
Yeah.
Can you go back to the slide before this one? Where is the Bohr radius on the slide?
It's down here somewhere. So the Bohr radius tells you about the typical radius for the ground state. So we saw the excited states, they grow like n squared. So these are all on the same scale. So the Bohr radius was some small scale like that. And here's the 2-1-1. So now we've got a donut. Everyone saw the donut? Three zero zero. So now you see there's a bunch of nodes where it's unlikely to find the electron, but it's spherically symmetric. If we make L equal to 1, then we have two blobs here in and then blobs further out. And again, the z-axis is pointing along that direction.
Does this one have four nodes?
Let's see. So I think there should only be one node in the radial wave function for L equals 1.
How can you determine that from the visual?
Visually, it's hard because we're also putting in the angular information. So there's nodes in angular directions as well. But you can sort of see that there's nothing along the sphere here. So here's 3-1-1. So now it looks like two donuts. And again, looks like there's a spherical node here. 3-2-0. Now I've got a donut in the center and pairs on the ends. Now there shouldn't be any radial node since we've got the maximal value of L. So now we've got these sort of conical donuts. And 322 is a big donut. So I put these on YouTube so you can stare at them ad infinitum. So it's linked on our webpage. You go to my webpage for the course. You can click on a link and see all of those and try to imagine in your head how that relates to a Legendre polynomial. This was just what cares about that spectroscopy. So astronomers and cosmologists care about spectroscopy because when you have a distant quasar, the light coming from the quasar gets absorbed by hydrogen that's floating around in space, and it absorbs on those spectral lines. So you see a dip in the light curve from a quasar. But if there's lots and lots of different clouds of dust, they're all redshifted by different amounts, then a single spectral line will give you a whole bunch of absorption lines, one for each cloud that it goes through. So you can map out the structure of how hydrogen is distributed in space, looking at quasar Lyman alpha absorption lines in quasar spectra. Okay, now we get to do the fun stuff. So you guys read about angular momentum? So classically, angular momentum is r cross p. Some components, Lx is ypz minus zpy, and then cyclic for the other guys. And last quarter, you convinced yourself that momentum is represented by a derivative operator in quantum mechanics. So if we just naively plug in these operator forms for the momenta into this, we can calculate commutators of Lx and Ly, for example. So Lx is ypz minus zpy, and Ly is zpx minus xpz. And we can expand that commutator out. So there's a commutator between this guy and this guy, and this guy and this guy. And this guy had a minus sign, so there's a minus sign in front of there. And then this guy has a minus sign, commutator with this guy, minus minus, commutator with this guy gets a plus. Now, y commutes with z and px, because px is not going to do anything to py. So we can bring that guy out. And px meets with pz, so we can bring that guy out. But z and pz do not commute, so we have to keep track of them. And we've got pz and pz, so everything commutes here, zero. Px, py, and z's, that's all zero. And then, again, we have a pz and a z, so we have to keep track of that one. And we're supposed to know that these commutators, this gives us zpz, gives us ih bar, and this gives us minus ih bar. And now we've got something that we recognize. Xpy minus ypx is lz. So the commutator of lx with ly is ih bar lz. And we didn't use anything that you didn't learn last quarter. So this is all review. So you can go through and do this for all the combinations, and you get that it works cyclically. So as long as the order is x, y, z, you have plus sign, so y, z, x, that's cyclic. Z, x, y, that's cyclic. So those are all plus. And can do the same. We can work out the commutators for L squared, too. So L squared is just L dot L. So it's the sum of those squares. So if we work out the commutator of L squared with Lx, we'll have Lx squared with Lx plus Ly squared with Lx, Lz squared with Lx. And then to simplify that, it's a big mess, but there's a trick. So if you have a commutator AB commutator with C, that's the same as A times the commutator of BC plus commutator of AC times b. The reason that's true is if we expand this out, this is abc minus cab, that's the commutator. If we add acb and subtract acb in the middle, then this combination is a times bc commutator, and this combination is commutator ac times b. So we can use that up here, because we have, lx squared commutes with lx, because lx commutes with lx. Things commute with themselves. So he's gone. This guy, we can apply this trick. So we can write this as ly times the commutator of ly lx, plus ly lx times commutator times ly. And the same for this guy. We can pull an lz out front, and another one with an lz on the end. And then these commutators we worked out on the previous slide. So this is not cyclic, so we get a minus ih bar lz. That's the same guy. But lz lx is cyclic, so we get a plus ih bar. And everything cancels. This cancels with that. That cancels with that. So l squared and lx commute. And you can go through and check that L squared with Ly commutes, and with Lz. Not surprising, because there shouldn't be any difference between X and Z, right? If one of them commutes, they're all going to commute. So L squared commutes with L. That's too much for one day, so we're going to do something simpler. So when we solved our three-dimensional Schrodinger equation, we found that there are two eigenvalues associated with the angular dependence. So that means we need two pieces of information to completely specify the angular wave function. So we should be able to choose two commuting observables to give us that information. And since L squared and L commute, we can choose L squared and LZ to be our observables. We could have chosen LX if we wanted to, but for historical reasons, someone picked it, Z, because the magnetic field points in the Z direction, obviously. Everyone chooses Z, right? So we'll choose Z. So we'll call the eigenvalue of L squared lambda and the eigenvalue of LZ mu, not to be confused with the reduced mass. So we should be able to find eigenstates that have eigenvalues of both of these guys simultaneously, because these guys commute. We can't, once we pick LZ, then we can't also say what LX and LY are, because they don't commute with LZ. So we can't have something that's an eigenfunction or an eigenstate of LZ and LX. But we can have LZ and L squared. And then, to make life simple, people realized they could introduce raising and lowering operators, just like harmonic oscillators. So we have LX plus or minus I LY. And we can calculate the commutators of those. So LZ with a raising or lowering operator has piece LZ commute with LX, plus or minus commutator of LZ, LY. This guy is in cyclic order, so it's IH bar LY. And this guy is not. So we have plus or minus I times minus I H bar LX. Which is just plus or minus H bar L plus minus. Okay. And we also know that L squared with the raising and lowering operator is zero, commutator, because L squared commutes with Lx and it commutes with Ly. So let's look at what the raising operator does to a particular eigenstate. So phi was an eigenstate that had an eigenvalue lambda for L squared. So what eigenvalue does this raising operator have when it acts on phi? So that's, since these guys commute, that's the same as L plus L minus L squared phi, which is L plus L minus lambda phi, which is lambda times L plus L minus phi. So if we think of L plus or L minus acting on phi as the state, then it has an eigenvalue lambda. So it has the same eigenvalue as phi does. Do the same thing for LZ. So we'll subtract an L plus L minus LZ and add an L plus L minus LZ. So we can write things in terms of commutators. So this commutator is plus or minus h bar L plus minus, and phi had an eigenvalue mu for LZ. So combining those terms, that's mu plus or minus h bar times L plus minus acting on phi. So L plus or minus acting on phi has a different eigenvalue from phi. So eigenvalue is mu plus or minus h bar. So that's why we call them plus and minus, why they're raising and lowering operators. Because acting with the raising or lowering raises or lowers the eigenvalue of LZ. So we know that the eigenvalue of LZ squared has to be less than the eigenvalue of L squared. This is this squared plus some other stuff squared. And unless L is zero, it's even strictly greater than, unless the eigenvalue is zero, because you can't point the angular momentum all in the Z direction. So how is it possible that we have this raising operator, we can keep going with L plus, keep making this eigenvalue bigger and bigger and bigger, but it has to be less than lambda, which is some fixed number. So both of these statements are true. This gets increased by one unit of h bar every time we use L plus. But this thing has to be less than a fixed value lambda. So what has to happen is that at some point, this piece vanishes. So L plus acting on one of these vanishes, and then the series terminates, and you can't go any higher. So we'll call that there's some state that's the top state. I'll call it phi t. And when we try to raise phi t one more step, it just vanishes. So we can't go any further. So phi t must have some eigenvalue for LZ, and we'll call that L, because we've read ahead in the book and we know the answer. And it's still has an eigenvalue lambda under L squared. Next step is that we're going to write L squared in terms of our raising and lowering operators. If we can do that, then we can use the trick that the raising operator on this guy will vanish, and suddenly we'll get a magically simple formula. So we need to know what L plus minus times L minus plus is. Multiply them out. So Lx times Lx is Lx squared, and plus minus I Ly times minus plus I Ly, we get a minus times I squared, so it's plus Ly squared. And then what's left over, we'll have an Lx Ly, which has a minus plus I in front of it. And then we'll have LYLX, which has a plus minus in front of it. So there's a minus sign there. So we can write this as L squared minus LZ squared. Minus plus I times this commutator. That's I bar LZ. So we get L squared minus LZ squared plus or minus H bar LZ. So here's where the difference between classical angular momentum and quantum angular momentum is. Because classically, these guys would have commuted. So this would have been zero. But it's got an H bar because there's some quantum effect coming. So if we apply, now we can write L squared in terms of these guys. So L squared acting on our top state, we can write as L minus L plus LZ squared plus H bar LZ. This raising operator acting on the top state is zero. LZ squared, that's an LZ has an eigenvalue H bar mu. We get H bar squared. Oops. For the top state, we called it L. It has an eigenvalue of L times H bar. So we get H bar squared L squared. And then here, we get another factor of H bar L. H bar squared, because there's an H bar there already. So we get H bar squared L times L plus 1. So that's what. So the thing that we called lambda before, the eigenvalue of L squared, in terms of this top state, has to be H bar squared L times L plus 1. Now we can do the same thing with the lowering operator. If we use the... Oh. You guys are supposed to scream at me or something. Okay, we'll do the lowering operator on Wednesday. The poll is online. 6 people have managed to make it work and record their votes. So the poll will close an hour before class on Wednesday, and we'll see the results. And the solutions are online as well. You have to go to the Harvard website to see the solutions.